Hey, this is Russell, and I work at the video store, the place that we can all go to every week when it's movie night. On days like today, interesting people pop in to rent something. We go through the films that they've loved across their life, and we are just here to help you figure out what you could be watching on streaming platforms and out in cinemas. All right, let's do it. Let's open up the shop. Did you see that thing yesterday on the TV? Top of the morning.
Morning, Russell.
Hi, guys.
How you guys doing, man?
All right. How are you?
Yeah, I'm lekker. Happy Thursday.
Yeah.
Is everyone having a good Thursday?
Yeah.
It's better than last Thursday.
Better than last. That's all that we can do. It's just onwards and upwards. Welcome to the video store. Thank you for popping into our video store. Today is a special episode. This is a nice little bonus that we do every now and again when we have a guest. So this is when an interesting customer of ours pops in to rent something. This week we have Vafa Narahi popping in. He is an incredible comic, a stand-up comedian who won a bunch of awards at this year's Comics Choice Award, and I think is on the cusp of some really amazing things. For those who know Vafa, hopefully this is going to be an interesting chat for you, where I think you'll get to know him in a different light. We go at it through the point of view of film and what you're watching. But for those who don't know Vafa, I think this is a very exciting time in his career where he's breaking through and really doing some amazing stuff. So I think this is a good chance to get to know him at this point and to get into his career and to know about him, because he really is something special. So I'm looking forward to having him pop in, and so I think that's going to be a good chat. That's going to happen in a moment. Are you guys cool to do some work?
Sure.
Before Fafa comes?
Yeah, I'm just going to sit here on the side and watch you guys talk to each other.
That's okay. That could work.
Silently. I'll just sit in silence and think of a bit.
Okay. All right, let's get into it. This is Vafa popping in to rent something. How's it, man?
Good, thanks, Russell. How are you?
Cool, man. It's nice to see you. It's nice to get to know you, because I saw you win all those awards this year at the Comics Choice Award. I was so impressed by your acceptance speeches.
And that's what stuck out. Like not the awards. You just like the acceptance They should have had an award for the acceptance speeches, like the best acceptance.
The best acceptance speech, and it comes at the end. I like to believe I have a relatively good radar of the comics because we have our weekly comedy show
at the Bioscope.
Bioscope, yes. Sundays, but
amazing show, by the way. I was noting to Ndumiso Lindy yesterday,
yeah,
that this first of all, I think it's probably the only real show that is the only real consistent show in Joburg, which is meaningful. You come here and you can perform, and you've got like good feedback that you can take on and go and put in a show. So he told me that if he wants to test anything, he would only come here and not anywhere else. I think there's probably one or two other shows in Joburg, but on a weekly basis.
Yeah.
And I think almost like a year ago, it wasn't as great as it is right now. A year ago, it was still like touch and go. You'd come to one show, it would be good. You'd come to another show, and then it would just be like, there's a weird tension in the room or whatever.
Sure.
But for the most recent past, I think for the past five shows or so that I've come to...
Okay, so you've come a few times.
Yeah, I've come a few times. Sometimes to perform and sometimes just to watch. It's just been like a crowd that's just ready to have fun. And
sometimes you need time and you need momentum. And so the Bioscope gets up every day and does its job. And so we are built to be a marathon place. We're built to do something weekly, monthly, daily. And so when Shanray came to me with this idea of a weekly comedy show, I was initially reluctant because I like the fact that our schedule can move and shake and someone can book and someone can do that. But when we realized we could do Sundays, I was excited for a few reasons. One is most folk don't book an event on a Sunday night. And I have always, in Joburg, been a part of and enjoyed the Sunday comedy night. So it was very famously at Cool Runnings in Melville, the Comedy Underground.
Was that on a Sunday?
It was a Sunday night. And that's when we were watching Trevor Noah and Kagiso Lediga and Loiso Gola. Like, you know, this was formative. Then it moved to The Box,
yes,
which was at Pop Art, which were our friends. So it happened kind of adjacent to us for many years. And then when things changed and moved and COVID and Pop Art was no more, we could now do stand-up here at the Bioscope. And so I take great joy in kind of feeling like it's still that same mantle, because in a way, Underground blessed Pop Art, and Pop Art like blessed us in a way. So it was lovely. And of course, just going back to the Comics Choice Award, this year it was so lovely that the show won an award.
Yes.
And I think
yes.
that gave Tsitsi and Shanray, who are the hosts, some confidence. It gave us some energy. And I think that really helped like find the formula. But just to talk about you, you really shine on that night because you won best new comic, right?
No. It was Breakthrough Award.
Breakthrough Award.
Which is like it's a very interesting.
It's not a newcomer, it's like just past newcomer, right?
Just past newcomer. For me, it meant quite a bit because it almost signifies that now we accept you in the industry.
Yeah,
it's like as a comedian. Yeah. Because as if you're a newcomer, still with a newcomer, we don't know if you're still going to stay or not.
Yes.
So yeah, we're like, yeah, you're the funniest guy now, but we don't know if you're a professional or not. For me, like the just to get that breakthrough award was almost like the industry saying that this we view him as a colleague now, like yeah, as a
yeah.
peer.
Yeah.
Whereas newcomers are still like
let's see what you got. Yeah, yeah. Well, so you broke through for me that night. For some reason, in my own little world, and I'm certainly not saying I'm the foremost on comedy in South Africa, but in my little world, you entered it that night where I was like, oh my God, who the fuck's this guy? Because the crowd loved you. You were winning this breakthrough award and you broke through into my consciousness where I was like, this guy's amazing. Because for those who don't know, when you win a Comics Choice Award, you get given an acceptance speech time. But unlike the Oscars where you just thank your mom and your agent, what's lovely about a comics award is they give you a chance to do some time, like do five minutes of comedy to kind of show your chops. And they're generally pretty good and like people do a good job and it makes the night quite fun. But I thought yours were particularly good and it really showed your chops. So that makes sense. Okay, so in my head, it wasn't a newcomer, it was a breakthrough. Then you won a second award, huh?
So the second award was for my comedy content, so online.
Okay.
So that is also, I think, over the past year, 5 years or so, 6 years or so, has gained a lot of positive traction. So that was an acknowledgement on that. So for me, it was almost like the perfect night.
Yeah, it was lovely.
So it got recognized both for my stand-up and my work on comedy and on stage, as well as online and with my content. Mm. So it was almost the perfect night. And I mean, going back to those speeches on how you meant to do a set and everything. And for me, I thought about it before because I have, like last year, I was nominated for 3 awards and I didn't win any. And then this year, I was nominated for we were nominated for like 4 awards. 3 were personal and 1 was actually going up against the Bioscope for a room that I run in Cape Town.
Oh, shit.
Yes.
Okay, cool.
Yes,
I didn't know we
because
were up
you guys
against each
you
other.
Guys bribed them a little bit better
did,
than
no,
I did.
We didn't.
So to win, so there were 2 content awards that I was up for and then the breakthrough. I won 1 of the content and then the breakthrough. And I thought, okay, if I do win, I need to do a set.
Mm.
And then, but I was just like, also like, how am I honestly feeling, you know? And yeah. I think a lot of comedy has got to do with honesty and connection.
Yeah.
So what you would have seen that night is like me honestly expressing what is going on with me right now. And at the same time, you know, it has to be funny. There's jokes in between. Sure. So like honestly expressing my feelings, and I knew that there was a lot of comics in the room.
Yeah.
So usually it's quite a little bit iffy when you're performing to comedians, because comedians are not normal people.
Yeah, I know.
And usually, you know, the marker is if comedians are laughing at your joke, then there's something wrong with your joke.
Oh,
so they often comedians,
because they're laughing at you and not at the joke.
Not at you, but like comedians find the wrong things in the world funny.
Okay,
and they know what's funny, so they go and do that to audiences. But what actually gives them a kick and
I get you, because sometimes you can be a comic, and sometimes you can be a more public comic.
Yes, okay. yes. There's those slight differences. Or sometimes somebody's like, okay, I'm doing this for the comedians.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, I know they're going to get it or catch it, and everybody else is just going to miss it. So,
okay.
So it's always tricky having to perform at an event there, because it, like majority, like maybe in that venue, it was quite big. So maybe 10% of the venue is your colleagues.
Yeah.
And you're really half speaking to them, and then the rest is also the audience. So you wanna have a mixture of who you're connecting with.
But you did a great job, man.
Thank you, Russell. I appreciate that.
And then, so I was excited to then see you on the list for Bioscope Sundays. So we advertised the fact that there'll be two main comics on any given Sunday.
Yes,
and then we do love the fact that others can jump on. So you've obviously jumped on previous nights.
Yeah, on a couple of other times.
Which is cool. I didn't even know that had happened. And I actually, funny enough, after the award, said to Shan Ray, who handles the bookings for Bioscope Sundays, this weekly Sunday comedy show, I said, we got to get Fafa, man. Because like, where's this guy? How have we not had him?
Mm-hmm.
And he was like, no, I think he's based in Cape Town, which we're going to establish in a moment. So it was just exciting to then see you on the bill. And so how was Sunday?
It was very, very, very nice. The other thing that Chandra had asked me actually a couple of months ago, where randomly I'd pop in here and he's like, why haven't you told me in town? And I was just like, I don't know. I didn't even know if I was going to be here or not.
No, sure, I get
so
it.
I've just like so much travel. So he's like, please tell me when you're in town. And I think last month I was like, maybe this date might work. And please confirm with me. And then he kept on hounding me. And I was like, okay, great. It works. Perfect. Good. I'll be in town. And then I got here eventually. So I must say, the other times that I popped in.
But I love that. And just know you're always welcome. Because I wanted Bioscope Sundays to be that. And I actually think that it's so cool that I'm sort of living the dream that I always wanted, which was that guys like yourself could just arrive. Because you hear this happening. And this culture exists in comedy clubs around the world where, you know, if someone like yourself arrives, then it's like, okay, we can make some space for you.
Yes.
You can pop on. And then for the audience, you've got two people you guaranteed to see, and then you actually don't know who else could arrive.
Yeah, 100%.
But that's very cool.
So man. I just...
So you enjoyed it.
I really enjoyed it because I have been away for the past like 3 weeks or so. I was in LA.
Ooh.
And then came back, and then we performed, or a couple of us performed at like a Savannah event on Saturday.
Okay.
And then there's this Bioscope. So this was my first two gigs back after my travels. And there was just yesterday was Titi's birthday as well. So that was quite a special show to have him and Chandra have. And the energy was just amazing. I felt a strong level of connection with the crowd and the rhythm. It just, there was a nice flow yesterday. So it felt like it was between a conversation and your jokes, and the weaving was like almost seamless.
Okay.
I felt that in terms of, so sometimes you get, it's a bit more abrupt. You're like, oh, okay, fine. I need to do the jokes now. And then you go into the jokes, and then you're just like, okay, there's a crowd work and there's some connection and this. But yesterday just felt like a connection. I told them, okay, look, what's been happening? I won my awards and this is what happened afterwards. These are the comical events around it. And then went to LA and my travels and what I experienced there. So it was a bit of conversation, but also a lot of jokes. And it didn't feel like one or the other. It was just like a nice mixture.
Nice.
And I really enjoyed last night.
Because the Bioscope needs to be that gym. And that's what I also always wanted to be, is a place for you to be trying new stuff, because it's a small enough room to, you know, to try new things and to work on material that might be a bit touch or go, but it's large enough to get a reaction. So I really wanted to be that kind of that gym. And so I'm glad that you could try some stuff, and I'm glad that it felt comfortable, because that's the one thing the Bioscopes, I've always tried to make it. It's very unpretentious. It mustn't be cold and stuffy. It must be fun. Sing-alongs, drag, burlesque shows. And when we were doing comedy for the first time, I think you might appreciate this, I knew I wanted to do comedy when we moved now to 44 Stanley. Because when we were in Mabuneng, we never did comedy. It was a great gentle person's agreement between us and Pop Art that they'll always do live performance, we'll always do audio visual cinema stuff. So we never did live performance. But now in our new spot, I knew we were going to do comedy. I wasn't sure when we were going to start, how we were going to do it. We'll get to it. COVID, you know, lots to figure out. Loisa Gola walks in, just random. And he's like, can we do comedy here? And I'm like, yeah. He's like, could I take it for a week? I'm like, yeah. And of course, we were doing these sold out weeks with him because he needed to rehearse. And that's when I realized the Bioscope will be this gym for people to rehearse new material. He'd committed to a Netflix special, but hadn't been able to rehearse it because of COVID.
Ah, okay.
And then after the very first night, I made a point to go to him afterwards and was like, what was that like? Because I want to know whether the Bioscope could work for comedy. Mm-hmm. Was the lighting, the seating, the vibe, the size, the room, where the spotlight hits you? Like, what was it like? And he's not a guy to mince his words. Like, yes, he'll tell you something shit if it's shit. And he just had such good things to say. He was like,
and very articulate. He'll be to the point.
Yeah, and he was just, it was just such a lovely sort of thing to hear. Where he was like, this is good. It's a good room. It's a good room. And he actually, I think, messaged a bunch of people. I think he's part of, you know, these kind of WhatsApp groups that we have, you know, in today's world, where he said, like, the Bioscope's good. So he kind of also sort of brought the juju, which was great. And it sort of got started on a good note. It got started with fucking Loisa Gola.
Yes.
You know, for weeks of sold-out shows. Then came Celeste, guys like Skulk. And so I love it. So the vibe is great. And I've said this every Sunday, guys like yourself, just line the walls with good, happy vibes, good juju, laughter, comedy, making sense of the world. So thank you for that. Thank you for last night.
No, thank you. Thank you for having me.
And thanks for coming here now.
I also, like, last night in specific, I usually have, like, I have an arc of what I want to say, try out, or what do I want to do, sort of something to guide me.
Yeah.
In whatever set I had to do. And usually I'll ask, okay, how much time do I have? So I'll manage all of that so I can start off somewhere and close off somewhere. Yesterday I said I'd do all of that when the first person is on. So I knew I was on the poster, so I was like, okay, they probably put on the first couple of guys and then I'll be on. So I'll go have a look at the first person and then go outside, ask Chandra, ask Titi how long I have, and then by then, like, I'll curate
what I
have
to do.
So
you'll work it out. In the moment, just
in the moment,
or
just before I go on. I mean, I've got the jokes are always with me. I should just decide, okay, what do I want to do? Where? How much time do I have? What can I try? What can I put in? So they were busy here, and I was sitting outside on the benches. It's about 50 meters away. And then they're quite loud, so you can sort of vaguely hear. And then they're like, Vafa! And I'm like, what? I sprinted from the benches over here and ran into the thing.
Yeah.
And now I was like, oh, I have no idea what I want to do, what I want to say, where I want to start. I don't even know how much time I have.
Yeah.
And I hadn't even tried to figure out what part of what I wanted to speak about. And I just got on and I just started. And there was a point where Chandra and Titi walked into the room and I was like, okay, how much time do they have? And they're like, no.
This is you. Carry on. You're one of the headliners. You can go for as long as you want.
So I carried on, and then there was a point where they flashed me. So I was like, okay, cool. I'll round it up now. And but it just
felt good. Eh?
It was so dope. Yeah. And I think that was a really nice experience. I mean, it could have also ended badly, but like it was a really nice experience to have, where it was like, okay, just get on right now.
Yeah.
And just do something that's, it's not time bound. It's not, it's indefinite. And so to be able to experience that, I'm very big on like being present and experiencing things. I don't always get it right.
Yeah.
But
that's a big part of comedy is being in that pocket,
yes.
Being present, knowing how to move.
So having that opportunity yesterday was a pleasure. Yeah.
Ach, lekker, man.
Was a pleasure. Wait, who does the posters?
Me.
Because my surname was incorrect over there.
Oh, fuck. I've copied what he told me. I'm sorry. Shanray WhatsApps me.
Because the thing is Nagari or Nagiri or something like that. That's like more like sushi.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Then that's Japanese. And I'm
how do we pronounce your surname?
Naraghi. So it's N-A-R-A-G-H-I. But I don't know what was on the poster. The poster, it was a N-A-G.
I'm so sorry.
Something.
It'll never happen again. I'm so sorry.
Because I'll never perform at the Bioscope again.
We know you're not sushi. Talk about a trip. You've got something that you can return here to the video store.
Yes. I hired out for the last 2 weeks. Axel Foley, Beverly Hills Cop,
right.
The latest edition of that. So I've watched this. I'm here to return that.
Okay, but you went all the way to LA to watch this.
Yeah,
movie.
So I took the VCR with me to LA because they needed a copy, and I watched it
at the LA premiere.
Yes, so I called up Eddie Murphy and I was like, listen, I got this VCR.
Don't worry, I got a copy.
Exactly. I'll be in charge. So they actually flew me because I had the copy. So if it wasn't for you to give me the copy, I wouldn't have been invited.
What was that trip like?
Incredible.
Netflix South Africa brought you out.
So hey? Netflix South Africa emailed me and then called me up and said, hey, listen, we'd like to take you to this premiere. And it just, you know, often in my space, you'll get emails and half the time you're just like, is this legit? Is this not?
Sure.
There's a couple of checks. You just go and check up what the email address is from. So it's from like a communications company and you check if they're legit. And then initially I didn't pay too much attention to it. And then they're like, yeah, no, we're serious. And they only like hard confirmed 10 days before.
Hectic.
Before then, it was just like, yes,
we're
considering
you. We need visas and shit.
Yeah, but they had asked me, do you have a visa? And I was like, yes, I do. Okay. So that's fine.
Right.
So I had the visa, and that was probably one of the other
sort of reasons why it all happened. Yeah.
Yes, because nobody else in South Africa has an American visa.
Well, what's so nice is that America often gives you the 10-year.
Yes, if you're well behaved.
Yeah.
If you're a trusted individual.
Yeah, I've managed to have a few of those in my life. And it's very helpful because.
Yes.
Jesus, it's such a pain to get it once.
It is. So that.
Okay, so you'd obviously been to the States before?
But the last time I was in the States was probably like 17 years ago, about 17, 18 years ago. So it was quite a while back.
Oh, do you have another passport?
What do you mean? Oh, no. I have a South African passport. That's all. I'm all in. Yeah. Russell?
Green book, baby. The shitty green book.
The green mamba.
The green mamba that can get me to a couple of
countries. Get us into Ireland anymore.
Oh, fuck off.
You don't know?
No.
Last week, Wednesday, because like for the longest, for I think eternity, South Africans could walk into Ireland.
I know.
Not the UK, but the Ireland.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, that's just changed.
I don't know why I said the Ireland. But yeah, that's just changed. Funny enough, it was after we beat them in rugby. On the Wednesday last week, midweek, they announced
after
in the next 48 hours, no South African is allowed in here without a visa. I don't know what the thinking is behind that. But I think the Irish sort of had an affinity towards us because they felt like they were under apartheid of sorts by the English. And there was some solidarity, but I don't know what went wrong there.
I wonder.
Yeah.
Okay, so you watched the movie. You obviously got to walk the red carpet. We saw some famous folks. I saw pictures of you with.
So I got
Keenan,
to
Michael Key.
Michael Key. I got to meet him.
What was he like?
What a pleasure!
Hey.
Such a nice guy.
Yeah, gives a shit.
Yes, and very again in conversation, very there, very present. You know, he speaks to you, and
that's good.
It was it is such a nice
guy. Key and Peele is so special.
Peele.
It's an international treasure.
genius, and you know he's probably more the chilled half of Key and Peele. And so got to meet him, got to meet Jay Farrow. I'm not sure if you're familiar with him.
Guy from SNL?
Yes, I think he's got some segments there.
Okay.
Yes. Not. I don't think one of the anchors, but yeah, definitely segments here and there. So Jay Farrow got to meet Cedric the Entertainer.
I love Yes. You. Were you the kind of person that watched a lot of original Kings of Comedy?
Yes, yes, yes.
I watched way too much of that when I was in high school.
Well, I was hugely one of my real idols, or somebody that from that era that I used to that I watch a lot of tapes of, Steve Harvey, especially those old tapes, like the original Kings of Comedy, where he's in a yellow suit,
like pre-game show Steve Harvey.
Oh, yes,
he's like a bit more punk rock. Yeah,
yes, yes, unhinged.
Yeah. Now he's going to be a bit like the dad of America.
Exactly, exactly. There he was like an older brother.
Okay,
he was
so
like,
you got to meet Cedric the Entertainer.
So I got to meet Cedric. In the photo I took with Cedric, Dwayne Wade, the basketball player, was photobombing. Like, he's just chilling at the back, like pretending like he's not. I didn't get to chat to him, but
that's cool.
There were so many other. Didn't get to meet Eddie Murphy because he was so inundated on the night.
Yeah, no,
got in within 3.5 meters of him, which is not too bad. It's about a Corolla distance away from him. So that was
lovely. And what was the film like?
The film was I really enjoyed it. My favorite of the, because this is the fourth edition in the series or in the franchise. For me, definitely the first one stands out
as a
super favorite. Yeah. Then there was a second one which I thought was good. The third one I felt like it lost the plot a little bit.
Yeah.
And then I thought the fourth one had brought it back a little bit. Not as great, I think, as the first one, because the first one is just iconic.
That seems to be the review, was that Axel F. now, and this was made for Netflix.
Yes.
But of course it exists in the world of Beverly Hills Cop. So it's a reboot of sorts. I mean, not a reboot. I mean, it's a sequel. Seems to have been like a return to sort of what made Beverly Hills Cop good.
Yes.
But not quite stuck the landing. But
You see, the first one was super iconic because they obviously got... So for this one, it was so good to see Eddie Murphy back on our screens.
Yeah.
I mean, we did see him with Coming to America 2, but that one, the reviews aren't too great on
He disappeared for a long time.
Yes.
Came back with a film called Dolomite Is My Name. Have you seen that?
No, I haven't.
Okay, so what I'm going to do here at the video store is find the occasional thing that you can now leave with.
Okay.
So I want you to leave with Dolomite Is My Name, especially if you've now had Eddie Murphy on your kind of radar recently. Uh-huh, so this was a more... it's a comical role, so it's still him being a comedian, but it's quite a serious film. It's set in the sort of 70s blaxploitation era. I think it's based on a real guy who was an actor in these kind of like sort of cheap porny movies, like soft porn.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a character that sort of appeared in lots of movies. But this is like the biopic on him. And it's a great movie because I think it was a little bit more serious. So it had a little bit of an art housey awards tinge to it, but it was still him being funny.
Ah.
Where he sort of plays this kind of McFly, like Superfly kind of like 70s character.
Ah.
And so it's a good film. It's got some credibility. It's not a silly comedy. That's what I'm trying to say.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. Fair.
And I think it's worth you watching.
What was also, I mean, at the premiere they had some conversation, and I didn't know of all of this stuff. But when the directors and a couple of other people from the Netflix Federation were speaking, they noted that like the Beverly Hills Cop franchise, and specifically the first movie, was iconic in a way that before then there was no such thing as a comedy action or an action comedy film.
Okay.
So it was very novel. It was super novel and iconic film in the history of film, because that opened up the doors to Hollywood to like, wow, these two worlds can exist. Because they got Eddie Murphy off stage and he's super lovable and everything. He was doing his stand-up runs and then, and they're like, let's throw him into an action movie. Let's see what's going on.
Yeah, it makes sense that the two go together, but it, someone had to be the sort of first action
yes,
comedy.
Yes, and then
yeah.
Now you think about all of the, so like the Bad Boys and all of the other things that soon followed those.
Yeah, Lethal Weapon probably also came afterwards.
Exactly.
Okay, so it's interesting that Beverly Hills Cop was perhaps one of the first.
And they did it, that first movie was almost perfect for me. And I was like, how did they get it so right on the first one? And a lot of things that came up is that half the movie was improvised.
Okay.
Like they just said, Eddie, come in and you can do whatever you want. That's they said cool. They were a little bit more strict on this one, but still they gave him room where he's just like, what do you feel like? And he was able to really express himself on the movie. Because, you know, another thing that, I don't know, I either watched this somewhere or read this somewhere. It's horrible that I don't have the reference.
Yeah, yeah.
But they say there's the primary difference between an actor and a comedian, like a stand-up comedian, is that an actor, this also, it's not completely true, but I'm just saying
sure.
What is my experience of it, is that an actor lives in the life of deception. So their main objective is to provide an alternative reality to the audience. So in the one movie, the actor is a cop.
Yeah.
In the next movie, he's a drug dealer. In the next,
yeah, sure.
So he's never one thing consistently, and it's never the truth, you know?
Yeah.
So he needs to be so good at his job that I can convince the viewer that I've been a cop my whole life.
Yeah, and
know?
I know how to do this.
Yes.
So I am British, or, yeah.
Yes. So they embody something that they are not.
Okay.
Whereas stand-up, and there's different type variety of acts, but in stand-up in its purest form is truth.
Yeah, that's a good point.
So when a stand-up comedian gets on stage, you try to establish connection with your audience through truth, whereas an actor tries to establish connection with their audience through deception of a sort. I mean,
I know what you mean.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
So they it's almost sometimes some of my actor friends speak of how they've had a really tough time after being on a run on a show or working on a production where months they're in character.
They can't leave
They can't leave, or they just feel like, who is this other guy that I've been for this 8 months? It's just like it's an uncomfortable position for them.
Yeah.
They feel like they haven't been themselves.
Yeah.
Because really having to get into character, they have to do so many uncomfortable stuff. They have to live that person's life for the next 8 months if they want to be really good at the role.
Yeah.
I mean, you hear of Heath Ledger and committing suicide because he got into that Batman role so, I mean, not as Batman, but as the Joker.
Yeah, yeah.
And he really lived that, and that was an amazing actor. So often, even comedians, sometimes you see them when they get into acting roles. Sometimes they lose a little bit of their fire on stage.
Because they've sort of lost that.
Yeah, I don't know if it's equally maybe true for, like, say, perhaps a Kevin Hart.
Because every role he's ever been in is so similar to him, right?
So, yes. So, you know, that sort of works.
Yeah.
But, like, if he was to take on roles that were, like, so different, where it was absolutely no comedy and very serious or whatever, maybe you would see a little bit of a hit on, you know, on his stand-up and maybe some of the ability to relate to the truth, because you have to live these two almost opposite realities of life.
We had Shannon Ezra on the show. He's this really great South African actress, and she spoke of these roles and these characters, because she had to be in, you know, a couple of like soaps, you know, for many years, or Lioness has been going for ages. And she sort of gave this visualization, like all these women, all these characters sort of live within her, almost like these kind of split personalities. And she's got to sort of channel them. They're sort of behind her, little, like these sort of guardian angels around her. There was like a weird way that she described it. It was very interesting for me to realize for the first time that, especially someone who's had multiple roles, especially the ones that you've had to sort of really sink your teeth into, they live with you. They're sort of these ghosts that sort of haunt you for ages. It's interesting.
So an idea that one of my actor friends shared with me is that when I gave this this version of, like, you know, the, it's an art of deception. Yeah. They're like, okay, no, it's not quite like that, because every role that they perform, that person is in them somewhere. That's a part of them. So part of them can be that cop. So all of these characters, exactly how they say, either they live behind you or in you, and you just now have to accentuate this 10% part of you for like 100% of you for this duration of this thing. But it is still, so you need to find the cop in you. Everybody's got, say, the cop in you or the criminal in you or whatever in you, and you need to be that person completely.
Let's take a little journey at this point. I'm curious to know about your life. Mm-hmm. So we're gonna go through your life, and I'm curious to see if there were any films that came to you at certain points in your life that perhaps set you on a course or left an impact or helped make you who you are today. We've established that you have yourself a green mamba, a South African
passport.
So were you born in South Africa?
I was born here. I was brought up here.
Part of your acceptance speech at the Comics Choice Award alluded to your heritage, which I think is interesting.
Yes, mom and dad are Persian, or so we're, Iran is predominantly where Persian people reside.
Yeah,
so that is that's my heritage, if you are to go back. But they moved here. Well, my dad initially came here in 1981, and my mom only moved here after they got married. So it was about 87, 88. So before I was born.
Okay, and so from what is now Iran?
Yeah. No, well, dad was born and brought up in Iran. Mom was born and brought up in India.
Okay.
So her parents left Iran for India before. So she's my situation, but in India.
Okay, lovely.
And then I'm my situation over here.
Have you gone?
I've never.
To Iran?
Never, 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 never. Okay. And people always ask me, like, what's, you know, surely there's a longing or, to go back to your roots or something like that. For me, I actually have very little association with that. Yeah. I think my parents did an interesting job. I wouldn't say phenomenal or good or bad or whatever, but interesting job, where they facilitated a complete disassociation from their past and reality. They were like, you know, you live yours. This is your reality, is that you're born in this country, so whatever this culture, whatever culture you are, is somewhere in this country. So you gotta pick one or figure it out. But that's up to you. So and that left a, like, it was probably a little bit of like a crisis, because it's like quite a daunting task to give a 2-year-old.
Yeah.
But it took quite a lot of years of like reflection and understanding, and a lot of like butting heads with society on what they perceive as like the correct thing to say politically or not, or what to be. I would say the privilege of it was to be quite well integrated, and ability to just like absorb everything and be present in what my reality was. So
where were you born?
So I was born in, actually, in Pretoria.
Okay.
So my parents at the time stayed in Mabubani.
Okay.
Which was a township just outside Pretoria, part of the Bophuthatswana.
Oh, cool. Yeah.
One of the areas of Bophuthatswana, I think, was divided into, I think, about nine or eight areas that form the one independent state. Yeah.
But Bophuthatswana was a very special thing, and we had a guest recently who was from it, and it's a very interesting place to have grown up, because you were sort of isolated a bit from apartheid, in the sense that you were this sort of independent entity.
Yes, I think among the homelands, or the Bantustans, or the Bantu states, was Vendaland, Bophuthatswana, Transkei, Ciskei.
Yeah.
I think there's another one. I stand corrected if there was one in the Western Cape, Northern Cape region.
Yeah.
But Bophuthatswana was iconic, or in a way that they were the first one to obtain in like full independence and a full government system.
Yeah.
They're also the biggest geographically. They were divided into these 9 regions, where the capital was in Mabato, or where sister cities to Mahikeng, Mafikeng at the time.
Yeah, yeah.
And then there was a region as far as like in the Free State, close to Lesotho, Tabanchu. So Tabanchu in that area was.
Yeah, yeah.
So it was almost like there's pockets of this entity, because it was up to the apartheid government was like, we're giving them all of the crap land.
Yeah.
So they were like, there's pockets of this crap land. They don't happen to all be in the same place.
And we can have them feel like it's their own.
They made a big mistake, actually. They had no idea. But where the Royal Bafokeng tribe resides in close to Rustenburg.
Yeah.
That was also one region that was given
to
for the tribal land and tribal people to, or the native people of that land to occupy and own.
Yeah.
So it was only after they've made that decision that they'd found out that there's actually platinum there and uranium and all that. So they messed up a little
shit.
Bit. Yeah, yeah. And that is why like the Bafokeng tribe is the richest tribe in the world. And definitely the richest in Africa, because they actually owned the land where all of their minerals were. And
interesting.
Yeah.
Have you seen Killers of the Flower Moon? The
no.
Oscar film that was made by Martin Scorsese came out earlier this year.
Can I get that as well?
I want to rent that to you. What that is about, and I think you'd find it very fascinating, is in the sort of days of the Wild West, not quite sort of ox wagons, more like towns. This was a point in history that I didn't really know existed, which was when the government acknowledged that certain Native American tribes had to sort of claim ownership over certain lands. This was their land, and the government said, okay, fine, you can have this land. And because oil was on those lands, these Native Americans became very wealthy, which was not part of our history. We don't hear about wealthy Native Americans wearing fur coats and driving Cadillacs. You know, we think of them as, you know, more rural, right? History has presented them this way. But what's interesting about this movie is that it shows the corruption of how the kind of white man came into these reserves, into these kind of homelands, and kind of infiltrated it in such a way to get rights, you know, these oil rights. So Leonardo DiCaprio is a sort of down on his luck young guy who goes to his uncle to get a job, and the uncle's Robert De Niro, and he sort of convinces him to marry this Indian woman, this Native American woman, so that he can inherit these rights. And one by one, they slowly kill off her family. They corrupt this whole system so that they can eventually get the rights. Because these poor folk are wealthy, but they don't have control. They don't have legacy, history, understanding of money in the sense that these Westerners have. It's a great film.
Okay, I'll grab that as well.
It's a good 3 hours, but it's a solid, solid, great movie.
You know, and when I was in LA, we were in the Uber driver, and I was with a friend of mine, Donovan Goliath.
Shout out to Donovan, he's been on the show.
Okay, so he's very...
He's a lovely guy.
Extremely dope. So he's really into films. So
yes,
he's,
no, that's why we got him at the video store. Yeah.
So he told me as soon as we arrived, he's speaking to the cab driver, and I've forgotten the name. I promised him that I'd go watch the film. That's something else I want to get from you, but I don't know what the name of the film is.
Okay.
It's so I think Mark Wahlberg's in it.
All right.
It's about the porn industry.
Boogie Nights.
Is it Boogie Nights?
Yeah, it's a great movie. Yeah.
So they were talking about how that's a great example of what the entertainment industry in Los Angeles is like, or was like, or what are the challenges you could face. So that's another one.
I think
one
that was that film was set over a new year, or like a move into a new decade. I think it's either 70s into 80s, or was it the 80s into the 90s? I think it was the 80s into the 90s. So it was like the kind of glory era of porn just before it got like commodified and changed and like AIDS. So I think it was just on the cusp of things sort of dramatically changing. But Wahlberg plays Dirk Diggler. It's great.
Okay. No.
Paul Thomas Anderson. It's a great film. It's a great film.
So even like it was so nice to learn about so much to do with like the history of film and production and everything in Hollywood. We went on a tour before the premiere.
Yeah. What kind of stuff did you do? I've been to LA twice and I love the touristy stuff of it.
So as part of the whole thing, we took a tour of Beverly Hills and some of West Hollywood.
Cool.
On a bus right before the premiere. They took us around. And so what the tour guide was telling us some brief history of like the place and how this ended up to be the Mecca of like filmmaking in the world. And he was like, initially there was a shift and it was the discovery of oil in California.
Yeah.
So discovery of oil in California and Los Angeles caused a lot of people with money or people were seeking out money. It was almost like Joburg and the gold rush.
Yeah.
So there was a black gold rush. So everybody was running towards the oil. They set up these refineries. Now there's all these rich oil companies that have got money to spend. And then at the same time, because for the large part, like California was not inhabited, so land was also really cheap over here. So the place where Hollywood and Beverly Hills is was really cheap. So people could come buy large plots of land and set up studios.
Okay.
So the one thing that also stuck out about California was extreme good lighting.
Yeah, because of this
good strong good light, weather. Good weather. So before, most of the movies were shot in the Midwest. That's where majority of the studios were and everything because of the lighting and everything. But now you had a place that was coastal. There was now money with the discovery of oil.
And they had to sort of spend it on something.
And the lighting was good. And for a long time, most of the movies were Western movies. That's what people were consuming. So cowboys and made sense to have all of those stuff in the Midwest.
Yeah.
So now when they moved to LA, they could have that because of the lighting. But also now the themes of the movie slightly changed because now they've got a different, slightly different setting and they could explore a little bit more.
Yeah,
then there was also that portion of time where World War II started.
Yeah.
And then so film was actually started in France, or that's where it was initiated.
Yeah,
but because of the war, a lot of the big production houses in Germany, in France, and the other European countries couldn't operate because of the war.
Or they got bombed
So now there was a lot of those guys moved to the States to come and produce films over there and work over there. And they naturally moved to LA because it was booming at the time. I think they mentioned something like, I think 40%, quite a significant percent of the aircrafts and tanks that were produced for World War II from the States were actually produced in Los Angeles.
Okay.
So they had a big product because oil was cheap, so production was cheap, land was cheap, so they were doing all of that. So it was booming industry for the war. And because of the war, a lot of studios and guys started creating films in the States. And then after the war, just because they'd set up all of that cost, it just carried on, perpetuated.
Lovely.
So it was...
Those are great facts. And what also is interesting is post all of that, once this... system had been established and America was getting known for its films, the government also very much supported the production of films because that could support the American agenda around the world and populate the cultural mindset of the rest of the world to see America as the global leaders. Because if we all watch American movies, we can see America as the heroes, who always win the battles, always fight the wars and win, and we got these big strong heroes, and it helps support a global perception of America. That's how it was perpetuated. It's nice to have these facts explain the starts and why the conditions were right. But once set up, they were very aware that if we show ourselves as the heroes, if we show ourselves as the conquerors and the we can get our agenda across to the rest of the world.
That's so true, because I wouldn't call it a cyber war, but that's definitely
it's what we're experiencing now more than ever, which is this kind of war of attention and information.
Yes,
whoever's got the loudest microphone can deceive.
So even like when I think I read this also many years ago, the facts around World War II, and by far the Soviet Union with the Allied forces, because they were part of the Allied forces, or fighting against Germany Italy and Japan.
Yeah.
And they had committed the most amount of soldiers. They had the most casualties. So they were by far the biggest contributor to the war.
Yeah.
So they had lost a lot of troops in Germany and so on and so forth. But the picture is painted as that, like, the US was the lead.
They were hardly, thing, is that that's why they could make movies, because they were hardly involved.
Yes.
And the closest they got was Pearl Harbor, where anyone touched or bombed America. They for the most part, the American boys stayed out.
But all the films and everything portray them as like, okay, they were the big guys. They were the leads. They were.
They were certainly the thing that came right at the end that helped.
As
you said, the breaking of World War II was when the Germans couldn't make it through Russia because they couldn't handle the winter and they couldn't handle the cold. It's unfortunately, I was just talking to a friend now, it's unfortunately part of what's made this Ukrainian-Russian war so difficult is that the conditions right now, or in their winter, it's just been so shit.
It is
so difficult to fight in that.
I wonder if it's ever an option just to say, like, let's pause this till the summer.
Yeah.
Like,
chick yokes in fucking, a few months' time.
Let's have a winter break.
Growing up in that part of the world, any movies that stand out for you?
The Lion King, definitely. Because we all stood on top of the rock and there's like that dark area, it's Joburg. Boxburg, sorry.
Everything the light touches. But what's that? No. Don't go there. The elephant graveyard.
Growing up, definitely we had a VCR and a lot of VHS movies. And a lot of Disney movies.
Yeah, sure. So but The Lion King was huge and it hit lots of people.
It did. And it's definitely the standout scene is the when Mufasa dies. And
sure. We all learned about mortality at maybe an age we were too young for.
Yes. And like I think most people's experience would have been crying. And I think that it was so weird in terms of film, like, so the first time you watch it, you don't know what's going to happen. So it overwhelms you. And then even the second, third, 10th, 20th time I've watched that movie at that scene, it still gets me. And I know exactly what is going to happen.
Just shows you how great that film was.
Yes. So it's like you now, it's not a surprise factor anymore. It's not know exactly what's going to happen. And I've told myself so many times, you're not going to cry. You're not going to cry. And then bam, it happens.
No, sure. You can't help it.
So that was, it was also, I think for me, a little iconic in a way that, it definitely, those sort of Disney films were quite genius for me. That it allowed you to experience different emotions and different sides of you. At the time, I don't think I was completely I didn't understand the depth of my sensitivity. So I do like, there is a part of me that's quite sensitive as an individual.
Good.
And there was a lot of my, say, formative years where I would suppress that because growing up, we were told that, you know, boys are not supposed to be, you know, sensitive or cry or show emotion. You know, that's more of a feminine characteristic.
Sure.
So coupled with, I think also there was like growing up in a small town, there was quite a lot of homophobia. It was subtle at the time because we never felt like it was a problem. But now looking back, you're like, okay, some of the remarks or some of the thoughts we had were quite homophobic.
Yeah,
or not accommodating.
Yeah,
and then attached to it is all of these perceptions of what is feminine, what's masculine, what are boys allowed to do, what are they not allowed to do?
Yeah.
What can they be, what can they not be? And I think it's only later on in my life where I've been a little bit more comfortable with with me having, let's call it traditionally, in inverted commas, feminine characteristics or what the world viewed at a certain point as well. So being sensitive, being empathetic, having to express yourself, crying, whatever the case is.
Yeah.
So I've been a whole lot more comfortable now in my life in terms of being, okay, I can be all of these things and still identify as a heterosexual male.
Yeah.
And I can still be sensitive. I can be all of those things.
But did you think Lion King sort of started that conversation in you?
No, it didn't start the conversation, but like it allowed you, because I knew that during those, so I don't think there's an example, but like I remember every time I used to cry or get emotional, I used to counteract that by being aggressive or dominant.
Okay.
So that was a way of, and that's
that was
basically
something you put on yourself.
Yeah,
like you developed that as your own defense mechanism.
Yes, but now I mean, it is a common theme. So I look at it as a form of like toxic masculinity, because that's what it is.
Sure.
So, in many ways, I found that, like, okay, the siblings fight. So myself and my brother, who's 2.5 years younger than me, we used to fight quite often, and sometimes used to get quite violent. Mm. But I mean, we were kids.
Sure.
So we'd always call, and my mom had to break it up, and you're grounded, or this, or that, you know, corporal punishment, whatever the case was.
Yeah, yeah.
So I don't want my mom to go to jail. No, she's a good person.
No.
So
let's call this an attitude adjusting club.
Okay, yeah. So this is not a legally binding podcast over here.
Yeah.
And so a lot of that would happen. And looking back at that, there's some when I interrogated certain behaviors, obviously you mature and you would have fought for different reasons, but I was just like, okay, that sort of behavior, what where did it come from?
Yeah.
And a lot of that, I found that it almost, some of that followed vulnerable points.
Sure.
Where I was either sensitive or I was crying. So I can imagine if I was to watch The Lion King, I could not make my younger brother aware that I was crying or that I was sensitive or I was weak.
Mm.
So to fix that,
mm,
I would need to assert my dominance in a way that, you know, and that would be a toxic masculinity.
It's great that
trait.
You figured that out. I mean, it is such an important part. And like, even today, when you see on this like huge global scale, you've got these like powerful dudes in power, and you know, like there's a little 5-year-old boy in there that just wants to make his dad proud, or is just a little bit racist because that's how he was raised.
Yeah.
You know, and you're like, or he's feeling vulnerable, or he pissed him off, or this oak's got this energy that is rubbing him the wrong way. It's amazing. We go back to our sort of original core selves.
Which I find that is, which is quite scary, because that's not the complete level of like control.
Sure.
I mean, even just watching, okay, it's crazy what happened to Trump 2 days ago with shot. Yeah, yeah.
Jesus.
But like even the way they have to present themselves. So like Biden, Trump, to the world, to the US, trying to garner votes. They present themselves in a certain way, and you wonder to yourself, like, who is this person truly? You know, there must be more to this, but they have to show up strong.
Yeah.
They have to show up dominant. They have to show up everything that they know is going to be likable or what this role needs. But as you said, it's just, you know, it's that 5-year-old, 7-year-old just trying to mask all these things, trying to make their parents proud or whatever the case is.
Mm.
But there isn't a sense of vulnerability or authenticity to that.
Yeah.
So it's quite interesting to watch that.
High school, where were we? Where did you go to high school?
In Mafikeng, or Mafikeng at the time, what it was called.
And what kind of guy were you in high school? Were you telling jokes?
No. Quite actually, I'm generally more of the quiet, observant type. Like
okay.
I only ever, and I'm trying to maybe try to change that a bit, but where I speak when I only feel like what I need to say is completely necessary.
Great quality. It's a great quality in a human. Because I have often been guilty of speaking a bit too much. And I've admired the people that, you know, when they speak, they you know, you listen, because it's like...
It'll go through a process in my head where I'm like, is this absolutely necessary to say? And if it is it absolutely, absolutely necessary to say? Like, it runs through my... So often you're sitting in a conversation with a group of people, and then there's individuals who just speak because they want the air to be filled.
Sometimes it's bullshit. Yeah,
yes.
Absolute bullshit.
So, or they say it just to, you know, to cause a little bit of an argument or a riff, and they just love, you know, the chaos. So my tendency is to only speak when
so
there's
you were quite quiet. When did
quiet.
When did the comedian bug hit? How did that hit?
So that only hit about 7 years ago.
How old are you now?
So now I'm 34.
Okay.
Yeah, so I was about 27. Yeah. 27, okay. 28. So seven years ago, somewhere there.
Okay. What were you doing before comedy?
I was an engineer, so I was working on construction sites.
Yeah, smart. Yeah. Engineers, yeah. Fucking, it's that serious.
Yeah, yeah. No, I am very smart. Extremely.
Which engineering did you do? Civil.
Civil, and then I did my master's as well in structural engineering. I got that with a distinction. Yeah.
Congratulations. I've been around a lot of engineers, and the world has been built and invented and created by engineers because they are smart maths people, but with creative artistic brains. Well, the other way around. They're sort of creative people with maths brains. So you've got to solve problems, which is creativity, using your maths brain. And so it makes sense that someone like yourself could become a comedian, because you trying to make sense of the world, you're trying to unpack it, you're trying to decode it, the way in which engineers tend to be the kids that took apart the VCR and put it back together.
Fair, but also not. Otherwise, there would be a whole lot more engineering comedians.
They tend to stay in their jobs.
Yes,
and make nice salaries.
I mean, another stereotype of engineers is that they're horrible at articulating themselves.
Okay.
So they're geniuses in their own light, and they tinker, and they like sometimes socially anxious. They can't really.
That's
so
a good point.
So, which makes them brilliant in their own right. So, that's a little bit of a paradox.
Yeah, sure.
That they're not great communicators. Okay. They've got these amazing ideas, and that's why, like, engineering projects are sometimes half a failure, because an engineer notices a problem but just can't convince the politician that this is the right thing to do. You see, politicians are brilliant at communication, but horrible at making logical decisions.
Yeah.
So there's
interesting.
So I've had to, and this has been quite interesting for me in the comedy journey, having to, the left side of the brain is more logical and the right side more creative. I do feel like I love the stimulants on both sides. So I enjoyed my engineering job because it got my left side of the brain tinkering. And then the right side of my brain does really nicely in this comedy space. Mm. I don't think I was able to express all my creativity in the engineering space.
Sure.
Because it's quite rigid once you get into industry. They're like, okay, build this road. This is how it's supposed to be done. So you just try to solve problems in certain spaces. So it wasn't completely... So I wouldn't say I didn't enjoy... I enjoyed a lot of the aspects of the engineering stuff. And especially I really enjoyed mathematics.
How did you make the jump? Because you have made the jump, hey? You don't do? You,
yes,
do you,
no, I don't do any engineering at all right now. Yeah. So it was a transition process of when I left formal employment in 2019. No, 2018.
Okay.
End of 2018, but I went in and I went to one of my professors at UCT and I was like, hey, I want to enroll in a master's. And he's like, oh, your marks are really good. We could give you a scholarship. So I was like, great. So I resigned from work to enroll in my master's so I could have more time to do comedy.
Okay.
So because I knew as a student I'd have more liberty over my time. So that's initially how I did my switch. And then, long story short, COVID hit.
Yeah.
And then I was like, what have I decided to do? Nobody needs this job now because social distancing doesn't work out for comedy. But then the COVID sort of like fizzled out.
It was always going to come to some form of end, yeah.
And then I gave myself a certain time frame to see whether this was a viable way of making a livelihood.
Yeah.
And then there was some small evidences. By the time I finished my studies, I still had a little bit of savings from having worked. And I think my brother was quite pivotal in helping me make that decision of like, okay, give it a shot. What's your runway? with your savings. Mm. It's like, yeah, I could do like a year or two. So he's like, okay, figure it out in that space.
Yeah.
Instead of having to be 50%, 1 foot in, 1 foot out for about 10 years while you do your engineering thing, it's just going to take you forever for you to figure it out. So commit to it, figure it out, and now this is all I do.
Lovely, man. But it, at that start, how did you know this was something that you wanted to do?
It wasn't. So I've, yeah, I've
you sort of knew that when you wanted to do your master's, you knew that comedy was something you wanted the flexibility to be able to do. How did that first?
So I'll high level summarize, because I've spoken about it actually quite one or two times in other podcasts.
Yeah, but so no, let's not get so into too much. But yeah,
it's the main takeout from there is that I was unhappy with the environment that I was practicing my engineering in.
Mm.
I felt like I wanted a bit more. I wanted a bit more of like not humanitarian work. I wanted to serve humanity a bit more in my work.
Okay.
It tended to be like almost like 90% capitalist driven. Yeah. So I was just trying to make money for my employers.
Yeah.
And that for me, that ratio was not too good. Like I'd be happier in like maybe a 60-40 split or a 70-30 split, where the greater part, the 60 and the 70, would be more service to humanity. And then the 40 and the 30 would be more commercial.
It's such a nice way to look at it. Is that it was sort of for others, not necessarily just for yourself.
Yeah. So that's been something that's drilled in me from when I was young. So this, again, large influence from my parents. They brought us up.
I was about to say, did your parents give you that?
So also from a religious perspective, follow the Baha'i faith.
Okay. And what is that?
So that's a religion about 180 years old, independent religion, so not a denomination of any other religion. And we're working towards world peace. So that's the main aim of the Baha'i faith. We believe in like a progressive revelation, so that God reveals himself to humanity over time. So we believe Jesus Christ is 100% true, Muhammad, Moses,
everyone's
Abraham.
True. Everyone's God.
Not everyone, not you. But like, So we believe that there's one God, and this one God sends his special prophets to earth from time to time to bring a message which is relevant for the dispensation that they live in. And we're given a time frame of about plus minus 1,000 years.
Okay.
And we're told that this is the time it takes humanity to bridge a gap of maturity. So when humanity as a whole bridges a gap of maturity, they need a new teacher. And then God sends a new special prophet to this planet with a new book, which is relevant for that time, with more information about God himself, his reality, as well as new laws to govern the world for that time.
That makes lots of sense.
So
at one point it was Jesus.
And then about more or less 1,000 years after that, Prophet Muhammad. And then more or less 1,000 years after that, Baha'u'llah, who us as Baha'i faith, we recognize as our prophet and founder of the Baha'i faith.
And say this was about 100 years ago.
180 years ago. Yeah. That was about when he declared. So, and we believe he has brought a message which is relevant for today, and he has brought new knowledge about God. So although Jesus Christ, Muhammad, Moses, Zoroaster, Buddha, Krishna, it goes way like
it's a nice 8,000
years ago. So they, although they're all 100% true and all of their books are 100% accurate, they're true, they're just not, or we believe as Baha'is, that they're not relevant for today. So it's almost the way you could look at it as an analogy is like going through high school or primary school. So you had grade one, grade two, grade three. Your teachers were all true teachers throughout the grades. But now you're in grade eight.
You shouldn't go back to kindergarten. Yeah.
You shouldn't be reading the textbook from grade one. It's not
telling you heinous shit that some Americans are going on. But
it's not relevant to your reality.
Abortion and, you know, using that for...
So, yeah.
It's wild.
So it is, also, I mean, do believe that truth is relative.
Sure.
There's no, it's, truth is relative to what we know, what our environment is, what, you know. So a truth at a certain point maybe is not, does not make sense anymore right now.
Yeah.
But as human beings, we have a problem with relativity, and it's been a problem for many years where there's a word for these. I think we're absolute beings, or we like to see things in absolute. Like, for example, Russell Is he an honest guy or is he a dishonest guy?
Yeah, no.
We can't say, oh, Russell, when it comes to running the Bioscope, he's quite honest. But when it comes to infidelity and women, he's quite dishonest.
Yeah.
You know, but like, people want to know if he's an honest guy at the Bioscope, then he's good with everything else. No, you're a circumstantial being. You're a relative.
Yeah, sure.
So, sorry, that also doesn't hold any truth. It's,
no, I know. Yeah. It's just obviously. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But
lovely, man. So that's such an interesting religion. I'd never heard of it.
Yeah. So that forms actually a lot of the influence in the way I live my life. And primarily my parents, they would have been Baha'is and also brought us up in the Baha'i faith. So the Baha'i faith is very...
Does it generate, does it sort of come from Persian region?
Yes. So okay. The founder Baha'u'llah was born in Iran.
Okay.
And then from there exiled over about like 9-12 years.
And when did this person pass away? If it was about 180 about years like, ago?
Maybe 120, 130 years ago. So it was around the 1890s.
Okay.
Yes. So fairly recent, if you look at the history of religion.
Yeah.
So like the main aim of the Baha'i faith is working towards world peace, but a very central theme of the Baha'i faith is service to humanity. That is a big, and I'm just looking at my parents and how super selfless they are. So growing up in that household, that's how we were brought up. Like you put everybody else before yourselves.
But it's interesting that manifested for you in comedy, because you do give a great service. You bring insight. You bring levity. You bring humor. You bring joy.
Yeah. So initially, if I'm just to summarize the transition, I wanted to just leave my engineering environment. And I was like, okay, what else can engineers do? They can work at banks. They could work at investment banks. They could work for management consultants. And I looked at all of those jobs and I was like, this is a whole lot more selfish than the capitalist engineering space, capitalist-based. So I was like, that's going to be even more hell.
Yeah.
And at the time, I wanted to do some YouTube videos and somebody's like, oh, let's try stand-up comedy. And I had no idea what this thing was. I started comedy because there was no barriers to entry.
Yeah.
You didn't need a degree. You didn't need anything. And I was just like, okay, let me do it. I had no idea how this thing was done.
Mm.
And at the time, I sold the dream to people that, oh, I'm going to do this service for humanity, as you mentioned. Like, okay, I do from time to time create a good service for people. And that was my that was what I sold to people about why I was doing the transition. But actually, internally, I did not want to do it. It was uncomfortable for me. I hated doing gigs. I would just go to gigs wishing they got cancelled. I'd go to gigs because I was committed to going to them.
Interesting.
And I was committed to being good at stuff. But I just wished that they would be cancelled and I would be allowed to go home, because I didn't want to do it. For probably the first 2 or 3 years, before it actually clicked and I was like, wow, all...
But then why didn't you work at like soup kitchens, and why didn't you do other service to humanity? Why were you so stubborn that you were like, I said comedy, so now I have to deliver?
Yeah, also, I mean, there is yes, I did say, oh, that's an interesting thing. Why didn't I go to soup kitchens? But
there's the love-hate to it.
So also, I mean, like,
Or you must have loved it, but were afraid of it. Or
also, half the times when we do things is because chicks dig it.
Good point.
Yes. So I was like, soup kitchens. Yeah, there's a market for that.
Not going to be any hot woman there.
You could. There's really hot humanitarian women. You'd be surprised.
Actually, that's a good point.
Yes.
That's a good point.
But probably similar reason to why you and your band. Yeah, chicks dig it.
Yeah.
So that was definitely a motivator.
Because
I think if you look at men.
Shout out to a previous guest, Richard, who spoke about when he was at the point where he could play rugby but could also dance. And he was like trying to convince his dad to have him understand that he's not going to pursue his rugby career, because there's a very big difference between holding up a sweaty man in a lineout or holding up a beautiful ballerina.
It's
lovely. He's like, I'm going to go where the chicks are.
But I would have thought that rugby players would get more chicks than
Listen, dude, than ballet dancers.
Yes.
If you're straight, It's quite something.
Fair.
But listen,
I guess if you're a gay rugby player, it's also quite lucrative for you to be there.
On so the other end of the scale, yeah. My last question is whether or not there's perhaps a movie you can think of that's like a kind of all-time favorite for you. I'm skipping a few loves here just to get to this one, which is
it's insane. An interesting one. I've only ever watched this once, and I don't think I ever want to watch it again.
Okay.
Because after I watched the movie, I was just like, this is the best movie I've ever watched, and this is the perfect movie. And
I don't want to ruin it.
And I don't want to ruin it. And I don't know if this is everybody's experiences, but I literally forget what happens in movies.
Sure.
Like, no. 2 days after, not even long, 2 days after, you ask me what happened in a movie, I'm like, I have no idea.
About two-thirds of the way through some movies with my fiancé, two-thirds, she's like, oh, I've seen this. Fuck, man.
So, but I definitely remember how I feel.
Okay.
And that's what I take out. I was like, I felt really good. I felt motivated. I felt strong. I felt emotional. I felt like I felt happy, whatever the case is.
What's the movie?
Warrior.
Warrior?
I think it's about, is it an MMA? I don't even know. I don't even know what it's about. MMA fighter or boxer or martial art. I don't know. Could you look it up? I think it's just called Warrior. Yeah.
What? Not Kung Fu, right?
No, not Kung Fu. I think it's based in the States. It must have. It should be about like 15 years old. 10.
There's quite a few movies that are called Warrior. 2011.
What's that?
The one that comes up at the top. It's a boxing movie.
Yes, maybe. Yeah.
Joel Edgerton, Tom Hardy.
I don't even know.
Nick Nolte.
What's the Rotten Tomato rating or IMDb?
This is on Letterboxd. It did well. It's sitting at 4 out of 5.
Which is what, good?
Yeah. The youngest son of an alcoholic former boxer returns home, where he's trained by his father for competition in a mixed martial arts tournament.
Yeah, I think that's the one. Okay. I think that's the one. I think
path that puts the fighter on a collision course with his estranged older brother. Okay.
I have no idea.
Okay, but you, this one just stands out.
It stood out.
There's something about brothers there. There's a...
Yeah, but I think... I can't even remember why it stood out. I was just like, I'm not watching this again. This is the best movie. That's it.
Cool. Done. No, we don't have to then talk about it. But just it's always curious and interesting to see what films come up for people. So that one left an impact. And I love this. I love, you know, for some people, this movie they'd settle down with, or this, you know, this last question is often a movie that they come to all the time. And I love in this case that it's
or
one
never come
that
to.
Just came once and just made an impact.
Yes.
That's lovely.
I think of movies and because I'm some.
So a movie's not a big part of your life.
No.
I guess it's
and
safe
one
to
of
say.
One of my friends was like, no, you should watch more movies, especially because I'm in the entertainment space and it's such an interesting
art.
Yeah, I guess so. But I do also want to get into motion pictures at a point. I think soon, quite actually.
I was about to say, is acting a possibility?
Yes. And I think fairly soon. It's I've had a couple of conversations that is pushing me in that direction, and I'm quite happy. But like I've gone for a couple of auditions and stuff, and I was sitting with a friend of mine and Mojack Lehoko, also a comedian. Yeah. So he was telling me, I was like, oh, I need to do this role, and he's like, you know, this reminds me of a role, and I was like, I haven't watched that. And he's like, this movie, and I was like, I haven't. He's like, you need to watch more movies if you want to get into roles or understand like the art of all of this stuff.
Maybe, but also maybe come in, you know, as you, and if you do give that good, authentic deception, as we're talking about
earlier,
then, you know, some of the best acting performances have been done by people who aren't movie stars, who didn't go to acting school. A great example is a movie like City of God, which is this beautiful film set in the Brazilian favelas.
Uh-huh.
And they used a lot of kids, street kids that were
Could you give me that movie as well?
Yeah, take it. It's yours. And these little kids play these fucking intense, crazy roles that, you know, deserve Oscars, but they're just being themselves. But they're not going to acting school, deception and, you know, bringing themselves and all the sort of training. They're just being themselves.
You,
and so you bringing that could be good if you're the right person for the role.
True. And then this was a month ago. I got called up by another comedian over here locally, and they were shooting something in Joburg. And he called me frantically in the morning. He's like, Vafa, where are you? And because I'm between Joburg and Cape Town. And I was like, I'm in Joburg. He's like, we need you to come to studio today. And I'm like, for what? And yeah. I'm busy. And yeah, like, yeah, yeah. What is... Like, no, we super need you. This is super urgent. Please, 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 please. And I was like, okay, I'll see. So I had a couple of other things to do. And then later in the afternoon at about hour, I called him and I said, listen, I've only got a gap between 3:30 and 5:00. And if you guys get... They were like, we desperate. Okay, cool. Please come.
Okay, what was the role?
So I was playing a Pakistani shop owner.
Oh, fuck.
Yeah.
Okay.
And I was like, okay, cool. And I was like, what happened? Because surely you've planned this production for months before and everything.
Who was going to be the Pakistani shop owner?
So apparently it was, they had found a Pakistani shop owner to play the Pakistani shop owner in this thing. And they just got him off the street. He's not an actor and they got him off the street. So I was like, you got the guy who lives that every day. How could he have not done that? He's like, this, it was so surprising that he couldn't be...
He couldn't act himself.
I was just like, just tell him to be himself.
Yeah.
So it was so ironic that I needed to come in there to be the Pakistani shop owner.
Yeah.
Whereas the guy who was doing awful at the role was a Pakistani shop owner.
Some can't do it. Lovely, man. But listen, I've found a lot of stuff for you to rent. So hopefully this has been a productive...
Okay, what are the lists? Sorry.
I've forgotten half of them.
No, the favelas.
I'm definitely going to give you City of God.
City of God. Then the porn movie. Boogie Nights. Then the soft porn movie with...
Dolomite is My Name.
Dolomite is My Name.
Okay.
It's just like porn movies here. And then...
those are the three.
No. There was a fourth one. The Indian Western movie where... Leonardo DiCaprio goes and asks
Killers of the Flower Moon.
Yes.
Pretty much all of those are available for streaming. I think except for City of God. That's a bit more of an obscure arthouse film. But Dolomite is My Name, I think, was made for Netflix. Boogie Nights will be on one of those streaming platforms. Killers of the Flower Moon was made for Apple. So it's an Apple movie. So it's definitely on Apple TV Plus and might be in one or two other places. Showmax is also a good spot to get some of the stuff.
Yeah, a lot of HBO stuff and everything there.
But lekker, man.
Thank you so much for having me.
What's on the cards for the rest of your day? What are you doing now?
Now I'm going to go and meet two friends of mine, Primo and Robot Boy. I don't know if you're familiar with them.
No, but they sound cool.
They're very cool.
Not many people get to say, I'm going to go meet up with Robot Boy.
Yes, and they're funny enough, those are not their original names.
I would hope so.
Yeah. One is Ofense and the other one is Mzwake. I don't know if people actually even know, but they're quite darlings to the South African public, especially in the social space. So I'm going to go and meet up with them. I have a lot of love for them. So hang out with them a bit.
Good stuff.
Yeah, catch up.
Lekker, man. But listen, I hope to have you grace our little stage here at Bioscope Sundays at some point.
Definitely.
It's always a space you can pop in at.
And thank you for committing to this. When just always looking at these spots, it's not an easy endeavor to commit time. So I'd definitely appreciate you and acknowledge.
Thank you. And I know that when we started it, I knew that it just needed time. As you said, it needed to find its feet a bit. The guys had to get really comfortable. I'm talking about the hosts, Shanray and Tsitsi. And it's very similar with the band that I'm in. It takes time till you eventually get to the point where almost every show can be a great show. If you follow the right steps, if you do the right things, if you put in the time, you could turn those crowds around. Obviously, some are easier than others, but it just takes some time and experience.
But I mean, not only the comedy show on the Sunday, but just referring to the space as a whole.
Thank you.
Because so often you would have dealt with different types of artists all over the place, and it's not the most lucrative thing to do.
Yeah, we were joking. on Sunday about the fact that the revenue of Sunday's comedy show is probably how much Trevor Noah earns from one ticket.
Yes.
No, and sure, but no, the Bioscope, and I think this is a lovely lesson for a lot of people to learn, is that if you have a small boutique business and operation and your costs and your overheads and everything and your staff size and everything is small, that relative, if you're doing well, then everyone can do well. Not every business needs to be scaled and in every single shopping mall. But if you run a good business well, then it can work for everyone, you know? So the economies of scale are smaller with the Bioscope, but relative to us, it's good.
Yeah, because another thing with Gayton McKenzie coming in as arts and culture minister.
Yeah, interesting.
I think it is interesting. And then he said that, you know, he's got a lot of energy and everything. And I think something that has always sparked, I think, I don't know if he had mentioned this or not, somebody was speaking about how there's all of these beautiful theater spaces across the country in all of these small towns. Mm. And if you have ever been to the Val, there's this this theater that looks as if it's set in like England in the 1960s sort of West End, or whatever. Yeah. It's amazing, but the infrastructure is so dilapidated, hasn't been taken care of. And there's such all of these beautiful spaces where us as artists would love to go and perform. Yeah. But now if we were to rejuvenate the place, we don't possibly have enough money to do all of that. So, thank you. Thank you for creating the space.
No, thank you, man. I appreciate you. And and if you are spending more and more time in Joburg, you've got a friend, you've got a space.
Definitely. So thank you
just
so much.
Know you can always come through.
When's Short Straw performing next?
Hey, we got a...
How'd you come up with that name?
I didn't name the band. It was named by the singer before I joined. It's a nice little play on being a bit self-deprecating, like pulling the short straw.
Okay.
It's just a little nod to that. It's fun, but yeah, we're not playing as much as we used to. Definitely, our busiest and craziest proactive days are behind us, but we do the occasional show every now and again. There's a festival in Drakensberg in September that we're going to play. Okay. Every now and again, these sort of ones crop up. At the start of the year was great. We played Kirstenbosch, lovely big sold-out
show. The summer
show.
Concerts.
Yeah, no, those are a treat. So when we get out of bed, it's for something either like just a fun, cool little punk rock show or a nice big show or maybe a payday. We would be stupid to refuse.
Would you say the era of punk rock has sort of... There was like a glory days, I think, especially in the early 2010s.
Sure.
Like 2000 and... Say from 2005.
I think there'll always be punk. Any time,
but it was almost
day.
Like super mainstream at a point.
Yeah, well, then that was like the sort of pop punk, the Blink and the... Sum 41 and all of that. They sort of took...
Hey There Delilah was who? Blink 182?
No. That was something else. I forget what band that is.
Is that just punk rock? No?
It was a bit more folky.
Okay.
But I know what you're saying.
You'd know better,
I know what you're saying, though. But yeah, there'll always be punk rock. Something that was so lovely coming from a guy like Dave Grohl, the singer of Foo Fighters and obviously the drummer from Nirvana, was that he said he took his daughter to a Billie Eilish show. This was now perhaps many years ago, but he was like, it was the creepiest, weirdest feeling for him to walk into this Billie Eilish show to see young kids dressed the way they were. And he was like, this felt like a Nirvana show, you know, which was early 90s. And he was like, it was creepy. It was so cool to see, you know, this kind of time warp that kids these days are dressing like, you know, 90s, which is, you know, something I'm a little more, you know, I can remember I was a part of. I dressed a bit, you know. I'm kind of your age. I'm a little bit older. I'm now in my late 30s.
Okay.
But old enough to sort of see the fashion trend and being like, oh my God, baggy jeans are back.
It's crazy. It's crazy how like the more things change, the more they stay the same. Like it's just,
it's lovely. But listen, man, thank you for your time.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for a lovely chat. And we'll see you soon.
Cool. Cheers.
Cheers. All right. Like a chat, like a dude. It was very cool to get to know him. And a very interesting religion.
Okay.
Which I didn't even know existed. So we learn something new every day, and that's what's magical about this, and especially these conversations that can go on for this amount of time where these kinds of things can be revealed that wouldn't have normally come out. So magic, go watch Axel F., which he had the very cool chance to go and watch. So that was cool to talk about that. Magic, thank you guys.
Yeah.
Thanks for a lovely day. You guys sat in your Buddhist silence.
Very effectively.
For a while. It's quite a thing, eh?
No.
And we've had people on the show, like Anton Taylor, who did like a week silent retreat before recording the podcast episode with us.
Right.
And I know a few other people that have sat in silence for days. I think it could be good for some of us.
Yeah.
I talk a lot. Magic, thank you guys. Thanks for listening. The home base is thevideostore.co.za. We have had other comedians pop in so you can see past episodes. And yeah, we hope to see you again next week when we do a Clerks Chat.
Yeah.
It's all of us behind the counter. We can talk about movies like Bike Riders.
Oh, yes.
We can get into more detail on that.
Cool.
Those are coming out that we have recently had the chance to watch, but we are not going to talk about it in an episode like this.
Yeah.
We are going to save it for Tuesday. Magic. All right. We'll see you guys then. Cheers.
Bye-bye.